This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Never mind China. Forget India. Some people are beginning to talk about the Saudi century, in which Saudi global influence follows Saudi money. This weekend, the Saudis are hosting Ukraine peace talks in Jeddah. 30 countries have been invited, including the US, the UK, India and China. And this less than 5 years after the murder of a critical Saudi writer in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul conferred semi-pariah status on the country's de facto leader, Mohammed bin Salman. A gigantic public investment fund involved in everything from sports to green hydrogen can buy you a whole lot of absolution. And Saudi Arabia seems to be planning for the longer term. So is Saudi Arabia about to become the powerhouse of the 21st century? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with a history lesson. Frank Gardner is the BBC's security correspondent. Frank Gardner, when was the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia established?
Well, technically it was 1930s, 1932. Some would say, though, that it dates from the 1900s when the Al Saud tribe basically fought the Al Rashid tribe and they stormed Riyadh. You could, though, say that really modern Saudi Arabia began in 1973 with the oil boom.
When did they discover this kingdom of Saudi Arabia, that they actually had oil and the oil was a valuable resource?
I think it was the 1930s, and it was very slow at first. The true wealth of it didn't really become apparent till quite some decades later. And it then became the Saudi Arabian oil company, Saudi Aramco, which is just this absolutely massive corporation. 5% of it was to be sold off, and that would in turn generate billions. So it turned Saudi Arabia in the space of a generation from this fairly sleepy backwater, pulling together a number of warring tribes that had carried out what's called ghazu, raids on each other, into this unified kingdom under one family, Al Saud, the Al Saudi family, Al Saud, who then managed this wealth.
And in very broad terms, how much would you say their influence has increased in the years since 73?
Saudi Arabia has been traditionally quite reticent on the diplomatic stage. They preferred to move very much in the sidelines. That has changed with the arrival on the scene of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he's known as. He has punched up Saudi Arabia to be a big player. He took it to war in Yemen in 2015. They've arranged, for example, a prisoner swap in Ukraine with the Russians. They're looking at a possible Saudi peace deal coming up for Ukraine. They have made peace with Iran, technically. Not that they were at war, but there is a treaty brokered by the Chinese, but essentially the groundwork was done in Iraq. Saudi Arabia is becoming a more important player, definitely. And of course, in sports, they are huge.
Talking about MBS, he's not the king. So how come he is the de facto ruler?
Because King Salman, his father, is in his dotage. I met both of them 10 years ago in Jeddah. At that time, Salman was crown prince and defense minister. He has managed to pull together all the strings, all the reins of power under his control. So the interior ministry, the national guard, and the military. And there are no challenges to his rule.
So here's a question, Frank. If he is so secure in his position, why did he need to do something like have a journalist killed, as happened to Mr. Khashoggi?
Well, first of all, MBS denies any involvement in that. He weeps crocodile tears over the death of this poor man. The Saudi official version is that this was a rogue operation undertaken with no direction from above. I think most people find that slightly hard to believe. These were 15 Saudi government agents flying on Saudi government planes and operating in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. But it's always surprised me how all-powerful, undemocratic leaders, who are often very popular in Gulf countries, they tend to have the support of most of their population, and yet they feel the need to stifle not just dissent, but anybody even questioning their decisions. And MBS has zero tolerance for that.
Finally, Frank, what do you think his vision is for the country?
Well, technically, it's this Vision 2030. It's a very ambitious goal to wean Saudi Arabia off its dependence on both oil income and the rentier system of imported labour from poorer countries. He's building this massive 22nd century complex out in the northwestern desert, NEOM, which is apparently going to be ecologically sustainable. But he has rightly identified the need to get Saudis to be more self-sufficient, to stop depending on foreign labour, and that one day either the oil is going to run out or the world won't want oil any longer, and Saudi's got to develop its own industries, and that's what he's trying to do.
Frank Gardner. Now, I want to find out how rich Saudi Arabia is and what it's doing with its money. Quinn Slobodian is Professor of History at Wellesley College in Massachusetts and joins me down the line from Berlin. Quinn Slobodian, does Saudi Arabia still get most of its money from selling oil?
It does. It still makes about 50% of its GDP from oil and oil extraction. Services are about 35% in manufacturing, a pretty small 10%.
Right. And how much money is it actually making from oil? Have you got a kind of rough figure for the revenue?
Yeah, I mean, it really moves up and down with the oil price, but averages about $150 billion a year. So it's the largest world oil exporter, you know, followed with some distance by Russia.
Okay. Now, let's talk about what Saudi actually does with the money that it gets. There's a lot of talk about this huge public investment fund, or PIF, that Saudi has. How much do we reckon is in it? And does most of that money come from oil profits?
Most of it does. We have pretty clear figures about how much is in it. At the end of 2022, they had $778 billion in the PIF. It was itself created in 1971 and began to accrue money through oil revenue, especially after the end of the oil crisis, which quadrupled oil prices. And it's really sort of building by the logic of compound interest with big surges in the early 2000s.
How does that compare with other sovereign wealth funds like Norway, for example?
It's up there. I mean, Norway's sovereign wealth fund, its pension fund, is the biggest in the world. And Saudi Arabia is about half of that, but it is around the same range as the Singaporean Sovereign Wealth Fund, GIC, and other Gulf state sovereign wealth funds like Abu Dhabi and Kuwait, with China as the one that's sort of approaching Norway and quite a bit beyond the Gulf and Singapore.
Who actually controls the fund?
Well, MBS himself is the chair of the fund, and he has been since 2015, which is interesting because that's even before he announced Vision 2030 and before he became the crown prince in 2017. So he's the formal head of it. Technically, the governor is someone else, a man named Yasser al-Rumayyan, who is also the chair of Saudi Aramco and incidentally the chair of Newcastle United. But he's the one who takes care of more of the day-to-day large decisions while MBS sort of retains that background role.
Okay, can we talk a bit now about how the money in the fund is being spent or invested? Let's start with what they're doing domestically.
A great deal has been happening domestically. I think that one of the signature aspects of the Vision 2030 idea is to diversify the Saudi economy. So if now it's sort of 50% reliant on oil extraction, the idea is to make its money from many other things. That includes a big push into tourism. They invested in and bought dozens of airplanes to try to make it a place that people come to as opposed to just leave. They have invested in a huge amount of renewable energy, including green hydrogen, including the world's biggest solar energy plant, including new forms of sort of petrochemical repurposing. The most high-profile thing they've done is probably this giga project called NEOM, which is a $500 billion, 10,000 square mile city being built in the open desert in the Western Peninsula with the intention of housing 9 million people and designed by some of the most famous architects in the world. The signature piece there, and it has to be sort of seen to be believed in its visualizations, is 170 kilometer long city called The Line, which will have, in their conception, two 500 meter high skyscrapers continually running across that distance, with all of the action sort of happening between these, in the canyon between these two skyscrapers. So the idea is to kind of build, ideally, these magnets of these sort of utopian new cities, which will then be powered by green energy, including the world's biggest green hydrogen plant on a semi-floating port called Oxagon in the Red Sea. So it gets a disorienting feeling, actually, reading about the figures involved, the scales involved. A lot of it seems quite implausible. But the attitude of the PIF and of MBS himself is that even if part of what they're striving for is achieved, then it will be, you know, something extraordinary. So I think we're not really in an era of the big project right now, right? I mean, I live in the United States and it takes years to build an elevator in a subway station, with no exaggeration. So the grandiosity of the vision, which we associated, I think, with China in the 2010s, the mantle has been seized by MBS and Saudi Arabia in this push for a diverse economy that might have its own electric vehicle industry. It will export energy to the region. They will develop, hopefully, breakthrough technologies, which then can be sold as intellectual property globally. So it's in that sense, it's a canny vision of a world that may be decarbonizing more quickly than they might like.
Canny or uncanny. What about internationally, Quinn? You've done a brilliant summary of what's happening domestically. What about the international investment push?
Internationally, I mean, they've had some very high-profile flops. Most notably is with SoftBank, the Japanese venture capital fund. They had a very big vision fund, and most of those things haven't gone well. But otherwise, they do a lot of more banal things. I mean, they hold a stake in Uber. They do real estate investments. They recently signed a big agreement with BlackRock to invest in infrastructure projects. There was this famous multi-billion dollar deal with Jared Kushner's real estate company right after Trump left office. But there's also now more of an interest in things like supply chain resilience and securing commodities. So one of the more notable acquisitions in the last few months has been taking a big part of Vale, the Brazilian mining company, specifically the part of its operations that secure nickel and copper. So there's a vision that if things move towards electrification, you're going to need more wires. Copper is going to get harder to come by. And instead of relying on the world market, they're just going out and buying chunks of the supply chain in distant parts of the world themselves.
Does MBS worry about whether any of these investments actually make a return?
Well, I think it's a high risk, but potentially high yield strategy that they're undertaking. None of these are things that are guaranteed to work out. I mean, buying Lucid electrical vehicle company from California and then trying to build EVs at cost inside of the Saudi Peninsula is not necessarily something that's going to work out in terms of profitability. But what's interesting is that they're kind of accepting lower profits or some degree of short-term losses for this medium-term vision of a more balanced economy, one that isn't just, you know, putting all of its chips on oil extraction as it had been for 50 years. It's really a shift to say, even though we could keep on making the best profits just by doing the one thing that we've been doing for almost a century now, which is pumping oil out of the ground, what we're going to do is hedge our bets, even at the cost of lower short-term profits. So it's a gamble, for sure. But one could argue that the way that politics have been moving and geopolitics have been moving, it would be more of a gamble to just assume that there will be a global oil market for the indefinite future.
Finally, Quinn, when we look at the longer term, do you think Saudi can be confident it'll be able to replace lost oil revenues with these revenues from new investments?
Well, I think this is part of the sort of disorienting quality of Saudi Arabia right now, is because on the one hand, they're making these pushes into renewables and green technologies that are, I think, praiseworthy from any sort of angle. Even if they're being made for profit, they're nonetheless, you know, likely producing technologies that will be helpful for an energy transition. But at the same time, they're, with China, the loudest voices at climate summits to keep extracting as quickly as possible. So what they're aiming for is this sort of narrow window where the oil prices are still high enough. They need to be, according to experts, sort of above $80 a barrel for this to be profitable. But they want to sort of keep on making hay while the sun shines, in the hope that they can, you know, then squeeze through once oil becomes, as it probably at some point inevitably will be, a kind of a stranded asset where demand falls, the price of alternative and renewable energies becomes so competitive that it's no longer reliable as a source of profit and as a source of revenue to feed and house its people. Because this is another sort of counterintuitive thing about Saudi Arabia, is they actually have quite a large problem of poverty. This is something people don't necessarily know about because it's hard to do reporting in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has not provided poverty statistics to international bodies for years. So there is lurking in the background here the kind of fear of a second Arab Spring if they don't manage to sort of finesse that transition well enough to have a kind of a new, a diversified form of economy to keep even its own domestic population placated in that kind of changing world.
Quinn Slobodian, who may just have blown your mind. Now I want to explore one aspect of Saudi investment that has recently become an emblem of the country's ambition, sport. The Briefing Room's Ben Carter spoke to Simon Chadwick, Professor of Sport and Geopolitical Economy at Schema Business School in Paris.
Simon, when did Saudi Arabia start to get interested in sport?
Saudi Arabia has always been interested in sport. If you look at sports such as falconry, camel racing, equine sports, there's been a long-term engagement with these particular sports. But if you're talking about sports that are watched by or played by others across the world, it's a more recent phenomenon.
And what's changed?
In terms of what has changed fundamentally, the pivotal episode, it's Mohammed bin Salman. 70% of the country's population is aged under 35 years old. And what I think Mohammed bin Salman has is a sharp sense of how 20-something Gen Z consumers want to live their lives. The emerging social contract is Mohammed bin Salman is really catering to the needs of and adhering to the demands of this Gen Z population. But at the same time, the bargain is that these youngsters, this young population, shouldn't pose a threat to the government and to the ruling family.
Let's talk about golf and Saudi's decision to create a golf tour known as LIV Golf to rival America's PGA Tour and Europe's DP Tour. What were they trying to do there?
What I think was really striking about the emergence and subsequent development of LIV Golf is it was really the first time that we'd seen Saudi Arabia not only pursuing its sporting ambitions, but really lavishing significant financial resources on the pursuit of its ambitions. Essentially, what the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund did was to entice some of the world's leading professional golfers to ally themselves with LIV Golf and to exercise a preference for LIV ahead of PGA and DP, in essence, by offering much more money. What I think was especially significant about the schism that emerged between LIV and PGA is that PGA simply couldn't follow suit. It didn't have the financial muscle. It didn't have the commercial performance to be able to match the types of payments that were being made to those golfers who ultimately did decide to ally themselves with LIV.
Let's talk about football. We've seen a lot of big-name footballers, Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema, to name a couple, go to the Saudi League on massive salaries. What's the plan for football going forward?
In general, Saudi Arabia wants to be at the centre of a new world order. And so if we think about the English Premier League and the role that the country plays historically, no matter where you go in the world today, people want to talk about the Premier League, they want to talk about City, United. And Saudi Arabia wants to be in this same position as being at the centre of a new world order. But I also think there is a hard bottom line, economic bottom line in all of this, in the sense that if you make the comparison with, for example, the Premier League sustains 100,000 jobs in Great Britain. And Saudi Arabia is looking to build a football ecosystem, a sport ecosystem that is generating similar numbers of jobs, contribution to gross domestic product, inward investment, export earnings, and so forth. So essentially, Saudi Arabia wants what, for example, the British already have.
Is Saudi's ultimate aim to host a World Cup or the Olympics in the next 10 to 15 years?
It is highly likely that we will see a Saudi Arabian bid to host the FIFA Men's World Cup. There are rumours that that could be as early as 2030. There are also rumours that Saudi Arabia may bid to host an Olympic Games. This could be in 2036. Saudi Arabia will host, for instance, the 2029 Asian Winter Games. And I know a lot of people find that shocking that Saudi Arabia could host the Winter Games, but it's won the rights to do that in 2029.
Might sound like a silly question, but don't winter sports need snow?
One of the things that people are beginning to realise, and I guess this is part of the purpose that Saudi Arabia wants sport to serve, is that we now know that Saudi Arabia is not just flat and full of sand. It's got a very diverse topography. Yes, there is the empty quarter in the centre, lots of sand, lots of desert. But we also know now that in the north of Saudi Arabia, there are mountains, and in those mountains, it snows. And so there is the climate necessary to stage winter games. A lot of people have nevertheless said, well, there isn't enough snow, but they have the technology certainly to create snow. And so what they're doing is they're making a play in winter sports to become a winter sport destination, not just for events, but also for tourists as well.
Simon Chadwick. Finally, let's look at Saudi geopolitical ambitions. Joining me from Milan is Cinzia Bianco, Gulf Research Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and Safa Al-Ahmad, Saudi journalist and broadcaster. Cinzia, we seem to be seeing a lot of Saudi involvement in what you might call high diplomacy right now, not just regional diplomacy. We'll come on to discuss a little bit more of that in a moment. Is that perception correct? And if so, why is it happening?
Yeah, I would say the perception is correct. I think it's fair to say that decision makers in Riyadh have sort of realized that they've tried a more assertive policy. They've tried the arms twisting techniques, and these have failed. And you know, quite simply, there were, you know, a couple of shocks and traumas that really reset everything and changed the calculus. And the most important one was the September 2019 attack from Iran into Saudi Arabia. These missiles and drones flying and hitting two of the most important oil facilities in Saudi Arabia and globally. And, you know, the United States under Donald Trump, which was considered a sympathetic president, unlike Joe Biden, but still, you know, the United States doing absolutely nothing about it. And so for Saudi Arabia, that was a trauma for decision makers. It was a time of absolute vulnerability. And basically, they realized that they had to change their policies and try the different way of de-escalating the threat and risk levels that they were feeling. It was incredibly high at the time.
Safa, what then explains the motivation of Saudi getting involved in, for example, as this week, in diplomacy over Ukraine?
Well, I think everybody's involved in the diplomacy of Ukraine. I'm like, just a few weeks ago, African countries got together to be involved in that. I think that's more PR than anything else, because nothing has really succeeded. They've done the same thing, but there are still negotiations with the Houthis in Yemen. They still haven't managed to pin that down. They did that in Sudan with the different factions that both Saudi and the UAE are backing, and they failed in that one as well. If we're talking Saudi foreign policy and diplomacy, I would say the era before King Salman was more successful and seen as able to be more diplomatic, like the end of civil war in Lebanon. The agreement was signed in Saudi and sponsored by Saudi. The war in Yemen, the previous one, was also brokered there. And so I would say that the examples that Cynthia was saying about the attacks on from Iran on the installations showed the weakness of the Saudi military itself, and that they bit more than they can chew. And they knew they couldn't directly confront Iran without the American backing, with or without Trump.
Cinzia, can I just ask you about Saudi's relationship with other, what used to be called non-aligned countries, then got called BRICS countries and so on? Does Saudi Arabia see itself as a leading country amongst those countries that describe themselves as non-aligned?
That's the objective, yes. Arguably, that's not already a reality, and Saudi decision makers are aware of that, but that's where they want to find themselves in a couple of years. And it all goes back to your initial point. The Saudis were really, really disappointed with Trump. They were already disappointed with the United States for a long time. Trump was kind of a last hope to, in a way, change their mind about the long-term decline of the United States as a meaningful global power. The disappointments, if you will, started arguably around the Obama administration. And obviously, we got a very low point under the Obama administration when he backtracked on his promise to intervene in Syria, and then when he signed the nuclear deal with Iran. And then when Trump was elected, the Saudis thought that because he was such a unique character that, and it was so transactional, that they could handle it and that they could sort of turn the situation in a different direction by establishing new dynamics whereby, you know, they had a lot to offer, especially investment wise. And in exchange, they would get, again, stronger guarantees from the US and a more vigorous involvement, even more strongly behind the Saudis' own interests. When that didn't happen, obviously, it was a big disappointment. But really, what they couldn't anticipate was that under the presidency of Joe Biden, that relations would go so low. And they really are, I think, at their lowest point after 9/11, I would argue. And then they've made a choice in Riyadh that this diversification of partnerships has to become sort of structural. And that's why they have started really to invest into the non-aligned countries, or into, you know, if you wish, different poles of the new global order, right? China, especially, then India, but also very openly strengthening relations with Russia at a time where most of the rest of the world is actually cutting back relations with Russia.
Safa, if you were advising the British Prime Minister or the British Foreign Secretary at the moment, would your advice to them be get in with the Saudis because they're a really big and growingly important power?
The UK already clearly sees the Saudis as a very important partner, with the indication that 10 Downing Street extended an invitation to MBS to come visit the UK. I believe the dates haven't been official, but somewhere in October or November, which is ironic because this is the anniversary of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And the UK government had been very vocal initially in 2018-19 after his murder that they would change intrinsically the relationship with Saudi Arabia. But the realities of Brexit and the relationship with Europe, I think, clearly made Saudi a priority. If the UK still believes in the importance of democracy and human rights, then I would advocate for them not to have a closer relationship with Saudi Arabia. But money clearly is more important as a priority for Western governments than what they claim is their interest in human rights and democracy. And so, frankly, I think the Saudi government, and more specifically MBS, knew that all these countries that claimed to boycott the country after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi have now all gone back to business as usual with the country.
Chinzia, very briefly, what would you advise a prime minister to do when trying to look at a future relationship with Saudi Arabia?
To me, the most important factor is that the balance of the relationship between the UK and Saudi Arabia is very messy and is very unclear, and it arguably favors the Saudis right now. So my advice to the UK Prime Minister, as to any other European head of government, is engage with Saudi Arabia, but find a way to change the nature and the balance within the relationships while still engaging. It's very hard, but it's not impossible.
Chinzia Bianco there with Safa Al-Ahmad. My thanks to them and to Frank Gardner, Quinn Slobodian and Simon Chadwick. And my conclusion from all that is, yeah, so sup, but with a long spoon. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Diane Richardson. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Have you suffered from a horrible trauma? Is it affecting your day-to-day life? If you suffer from PTSD, you can try our new pill, Reset.
From BBC Radio 4.
You are the 10 individuals taking part in the Phase 1 trial of our new drug.
Better Pill.
It doesn't cure PTSD, quite the opposite.
An audio drama series.
What was that?
It's okay, Mary.
What happened?
You're in the lab.
Where's Carl? Carl?
He's in the hospital.
Available on BBC Sounds.
if there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.